I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, Underground Railroad for Refugees. The New Yorker, March 13th issue. Jake Halpern is the author, and the story made me cry. It is so beautifully written and such an important story. It takes a look at the people who are at a safe house, Vive, in Buffalo, New York. Staff volunteers welcome asylum seekers from around the world, and a dozen or so people show up each day looking for advice, protection, and also a place to flee. They are trying to get to Canada, many of these asylum seekers, considering that it's much harder to get into the United States. And our guest, Jake, as a good journalist does, spent a great deal of time at Vive and interviewed many of the people who are seeking asylum, people from Eritrea, from Colombia, from Pakistan, Nigeria, Rwanda, and many other places. Got to know them very well, their stories very well, how they were trying to get to Canada, how dangerous it is for many of them to get to Canada, how many have a very hard time going anywhere and find themselves in long stays at this safe house for asylum seekers. Jake is an author, a journalist, a radio producer. He's written several books. His most recent is Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. It was chosen as a New York Times bestseller, Amazon Book of the Year, also producing an ongoing series for the New York Times, a nonfiction graphic novel that follows a Syrian family to the United States. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and many other publications. Is a contributor to All Things Considered and This American Life. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him as we talk about these asylum seekers, hear their story, and hear about this remarkable place in Buffalo, Vive. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to read your messages there, and we are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Jake, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, your story. I mean, seriously, I don't cry over many stories that I read, but I did over yours, and what a completely thorough and sensitive and tender journalist you are. This took some time. In many ways.
Yeah, the project, it was one of the, it began in the fall of 2015, and at the time, the idea of all of these refugees going to Canada was still, you know, not really in the news. This is well before the election and Trump's executive orders, but I had grown up in Buffalo.
Oh.
I had heard from an old high school friend that there was a house that kind of served as the penultimate stop on a modern-day underground railroad that was getting refugees into Canada, and that something on the order of 100,000 people had passed through this old schoolhouse over the course of the last 40 years. And I was just really intrigued. I had grown up, actually, with stories of the Underground Railroad, the real one, the Harriet Tubman one, coming through Buffalo, and it was just very curious to me that it had kind of maybe resurrected itself as a conduit for refugees.
Mm-hmm. And people are coming, rather trying to get to Canada because, as you say in the article, it's very difficult to win asylum in America.
Yeah, I mean, that's true now more than ever. But even historically, Canada had this reputation as being a kind of promised land for refugees. I mean, often people coming up overland through Latin America, and it was known that Canada had a real infrastructure for refugees, with socialized medicine, access to housing, legal support, that simply didn't exist in the United States. And so the path was already a fairly well-beaten path before the Trump administration comes along, and then within the last, you know, several months, it becomes something of a mass exodus.
I'm wondering what your impression was the moment you opened the door and walked inside the safe house, Vive. It must be an extraordinary sight to see all of these people, many of whom have virtually nothing, living in circumstances that where they don't have very much at all and really no particular place to go, many of them. It must have been an extraordinary sight.
Yeah, it was. And It's odd. I mean, basically, there are people all over the world that know that if you can make it to 50 Wyoming Avenue on the east side of Buffalo, there is a safe house where they will try to help you get to Canada. And people know this. They with only the vaguest conception of where Buffalo is or what this safe house is all about. And there's kind of a constant stream of people arriving on foot by taxi, and they show up. And the east side of Buffalo is a fairly forlorn area. About a quarter of the buildings in this particular neighborhood are vacant. There's poverty. There's crime. It's a pretty rough area. And they show up at this old red brick building. There's a church next to it with the windows all boarded up. And I think many of them wonder, where have I come? It hardly looks like a place of salvation. And then you open the door, and it is just hallways filled with people from all over the world who are all basically eagerly waiting, hoping to continue on to Canada, although not all of them can, and many of them have been in this building for months and sometimes even years as a kind of almost like a purgatory of a waiting place.
Mm-hmm. And each story is so poignant. Let's talk about some of the people you met and some of the people actually you helped. If you don't mind, let's start with this petite woman in her early 30s from Eritrea. Probably a lot of people don't know what's going on in Eritrea, but it's horrendous, and what she has been through is horrible.
Yeah, so her name is Tita, and she's kind of a good example of the sort of person that comes through Vive. So she flees Eritrea because she's a Pentecostal Christian and she's persecuted there. She's actually imprisoned. She manages to escape from prison. She flees to Sudan, which is itself a place that has a great deal of turmoil. But while she's in Sudan, she meets a man. They get married, although it's just a church ceremony. It's not a legal ceremony. And they have a child. And then as Sudan starts to kind of fall into kind of civil war, deepening civil war, she gets separated from her child and from her husband. The child and the husband make it out of Sudan to Canada, and she's left in Sudan without them. So she manages to contact an extended network of family, including a wealthy uncle in Germany. She rounds up enough money to hire a human trafficker who takes her from Sudan to Brazil and then up through Central America and drops her off at the U.S. border. At the border, she asks for asylum in the U.S., but her plan is always to continue on to Canada. She makes her way to Vive in Buffalo, which is right on the Canadian border, and she shows up there, and she's hoping to be reunited with her kid, who she hasn't seen in 4 years. Now, the challenge that she faces is that she must prove that her husband and her child are, in fact, her husband and her child. Because in order to cross the border into Canada legally and claim asylum there, you have to prove you have an anchor relative. Now, you would think it would be simple enough, but she doesn't have a great deal of documentation. And even though her son and her husband are waiting for her, like 2 miles away, and she's traversed half the globe and hasn't seen them in 4 years, there's a chance that she will see them, not convince the Canadian border officials that they are really her wife and son, and then will be basically deported. And so it's very dramatic. She's obviously very worked up when I see her. And she's in a position that a lot of these people are in Vive, which is that they must prove their connection to an anchor relative in Canada.
And to let people know, the story ends happily. She is granted asylum and gets to reunite with her husband and son.
Yeah, she shows up at the border. She sees her son kind of run through the building and kind of hug her. Well, he doesn't hug her at first. He's a little hesitant. And she just keeps on telling him, I am your mother. Mm. I am your mother. It gives me the goosebumps kind of retelling it. And then she has her meeting with the Canadian border officials, and she convinces them, has enough documentation to prove in their eyes that the connection is real, and then she wins asylum. So for Tita, it works out well.
You highlight so many of these stories and got to know these people. We'll hear more of them as we carry on. But what's amazing to me is I hear each one of these stories and I think, oh my goodness, there should be a place in the world that will take you with open arms. What you have to go through in order to find a place to live, the money that it takes, the uncertainty, the hell you've been through in your hometown where you've been persecuted and in many cases tortured, members of your family have been killed, and you don't have any place to go. It's hard for you to find a home.
Yeah, it's there's something about it, about meeting people like Tita that is just so bracing. I remember before I knew it was going to work out with her, because it took a little while. There was a way to kind of, the easiest way for her to prove that her son was her son was to get a DNA test, which cost, the one that the Canadian government recognized cost about $1,000. And she didn't have it. Mm-hmm. If she could get it, that would be it. She would, and as a result, like, because she couldn't afford this, she was facing the prospect of seeing her child for a brief 30 minutes and then being repatriated or deported and never seeing him again. And I remember really well, I went up after meeting her, before her fate was resolved, up to my family for a family reunion. It was the Jewish New Year. And we were all gathered on a table, and I told the story. And people, I think there was this sense of unreality that you might never see your child again because you couldn't scrap together $1,000 to buy this test. And in fact, my family was like, "We'll put the money together." And as it turns out, it wasn't necessary. But there was just something about seeing the story up close that just, I don't know, brought home the humanness of it all.
I'm sure it did. And here's another story, and you didn't know how this one was going to end. Tell us the story, because there are a number of people from South America who have come here to escape gang violence. The Colombian man in his early 20s, Fernando.
Yeah, so Fernando is an interesting contrast to Tita. So if you remember, with Tita, her situation was she had an anchor relative in Canada, and her test was proving that they were, in fact, her relatives. Once she proved this, she could formally apply for asylum in Canada, which she did and won. The problem is, if you don't have an anchor relative in Canada and you've come through the U.S., like many of these folks do, you actually cannot apply for asylum at the border. But there's this strange loophole in the law that if you somehow make it to the interior of Canada and just show up there, not, in other words, not at the border but inside, the anchor relative requirement is in effect waived. So it creates this strange incentive to take a really great risk of crossing the border illegally in the hopes of reaching the interior and making this claim. So when I was there, or when I really wanted to follow one of these stories, and I didn't meet anyone under these circumstances when I was at Vive, but a short while after I left, I got a call from this young man named Fernando, who was in exactly this situation. He was a 21-year-old kid. He was a clarinet player. He showed up at Vive with his clarinet in hand and was hoping to continue on to Canada, but learned that because he had no anchor relative, that really his only option was either to go home, where he was facing basically a death sentence from the gang in his town, or to sneak across the border. And so what he did was, in the depths of night, in the depths of winter, he decided to try to cross the Canadian border in northern New York State, north of the Adirondacks. And he gave me a call. I was actually down in D.C. visiting my in-laws. I got a call on my cell phone that said, "I'm in this town. I'm going to cross tonight. If you want to come with me, you can. But the police are following me, and I'm not sure how much longer I'm going to be there." And I basically ran, got on a plane, flew from D.C. to Boston, then on to Plattsburgh, rented a car, and showed up in this small town called Roos's Point just around nightfall. And he wouldn't tell me the hotel he was at. He said, "Meet me at the Catholic church in town." Mm. And I pulled up to the Catholic church. It's dark, it's cold, it's basically winter, and this very frightened young man runs out of the shadows of the church and gets into my car. And I pull away from the car curb. I couldn't have gone 100 feet, and the police pull us over. They'd obviously been watching him and said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm here to interview this guy." And they let us go. And then he tells me, I'm going to cross. I don't know if you want me to continue to tell you how the story works out.
Yes, please.
Yeah,
you have to now.
Okay, yeah, I've did the
right.
So we're spooked. Both of us are spooked. I mean, it shows you I had a small taste of his fear. I'm like, I'm American citizen. But we drive to the next town to a Chinese restaurant. There's a Chinese restaurant with the only people in there. He tells me the story, and he says, I'm going to cross, and here's, I've got Google Maps on my phone. I'm going to cross this golf course and then through a forest, and I'll make it to Canada. He said, will you drive me home and back to the town, to my motel, and get my bags and drop me off at the golf course? So I'm in this gray area about what I can and can't do as a journalist, but I say, okay, I'll drop you off at the golf course. So we go back into town. We get his stuff at the motel. We're pulling out of the motel, and the same police car pulls over again and basically says, what are you doing back in town? And we say, we get the picture. We're like, we're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're driving out of town. We don't know where we're going. He's looking on his map again, and he's found another place that he wants to cross, which is this farmer's field that goes into a forest. And he says, will you drop me off at this field? And it was about 5 miles away. And I said, I will. I will drop you off there. And we drive to this field. And the map, it had been a shorn field where it would be easy to walk across. When we get there, it almost looks like we're in the wrong place because it's so wildly overgrown. And I stop the car for a second. He looks at me. He says, goodbye, amigo. And he hugs me. And then he runs out of the car and disappears into the bramble. And I had said, call me if you get into trouble. Call me if you make it. And I didn't hear from him for 4 days. And I really started to fear that he had died. My wife, I was going out of my mind. My wife was just like, trying to calm me down because I felt responsible for him,
right?
In some way. And then 4 days later, he calls me. He says, "I made it. I'm in Montreal. I had a rough crossing. I fell into a river. I almost got hypothermia. But when I reached the highway, the Canadian police stopped me, and they welcomed me to Canada." And it was this moment of just like, by God, like today is a proud day to be a Canadian, where you can take someone, they're taking someone who's in such desperate need and
yes.
feel safe.
Yes. But he didn't have the same kind of success with the asylum process, did he?
True. So what happens is, he succeeds, once he's in the interior, he can make his claim for asylum. But when he makes his claim for asylum, he loses the initial court hearing, the initial, trial before the Immigration Refugee Board, on the grounds that he could have moved elsewhere in Colombia and, in theory, gotten away from this gang. But he's appealing it, and in the meantime, he's safe. And the truth is, Canada does not deport a ton of people. So even though he lost this initial hearing, he's still not in terrible shape. He's not as well off as Tita, but he's safe for the time being.
Right, and he has a job, right?
He has a job. He's working at a car dealership, rust-proofing cars. He met a girl, a Canadian girl. He sent me a picture of them. They look happily in love. he's playing his clarinet. I mean, this is the face of the people. There's so much boogeyman kind of stuff about refugees and illegal. This is the face of it. Like when I got the picture in my kitchen. Of him and this young Canadian girl who he met, and they're smiling, and there's just such a hopefulness in their eyes. And it was the other moment that I was really overcome by emotion, because it just brings it back down to a human scale again.
Right.
I feel like if most people could meet a guy like Fernando, it might very well change their feelings about who we ought to and who we ought not help.
We're talking this hour with Jake Halpern. His piece in The New Yorker, March 13, an issue that you should read. It's very moving as we talk about refugees in the United States and a refugee crisis. You read the stories of the people who are staying at the safe house Vive in Buffalo, New York, on the east side of the city, asylum seekers from all over the world. And Jake spent a lot of time interviewing the people, hearing their stories in great detail, and as you just heard, helping one of the asylum seekers get to Canada, because this is where many people at this safe house want to go, because it's easier to remain in Canada than it is in the United States, particularly now. The stories are heartbreaking, but it does leave this big question. what is it? All these people have legitimate reasons for having to flee their country. They do it at great risk to themselves. They are poor. Many of them have no money. They have to hire human traffickers sometimes to maneuver their way to the United States. Many of them come here first. We'll also talk about this treaty between Canada and the United States that deals with asylum seekers and how that affects those who are seeking asylum. But what is the world to do? What is the world to do? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email, talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we like to read your comments. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Coming up next hour of the program, we'll speak with the author of Who Thought This Was a Good Idea and Other Questions You Should Have Answers to When You Work in the White House. Alyssa Mastromonaco will join us. She served as assistant to President Obama and director of scheduling, traveled all over the world with him, and has some amusing tales to tell and some serious tales to tell as well about the Obama administration and campaigning and life in politics, and how her spirit has not been totally dimmed. She still has a political twinkle in her eye. 800-486-8655 is our number, and Jake Halpern is our guest. He has a wonderful piece in the March 13th issue of The New Yorker, Underground Railroad for Refugees. And tell us a little bit before we start going to phone calls, Jake, about this treaty that was signed that makes all of this a little bit complicated between Canada and the United States.
Yeah, so there's a treaty that was signed that went into effect back in around 2005, and it's called the Safe Third Country Agreement. And the idea basically was that if you land in the United States, if you land first in the U.S., you must seek asylum there, and if you land first in Canada, you must seek asylum there. And the idea is, you know, in some ways kind of has a kind of common sense underpinning that they didn't want people applying for asylum in both countries simultaneously and trying one and trying the other. That basically the idea was the U.S. and Canada are both safe countries, so pick one. The problem that it creates is that what is grounds for asylum in one country is not necessarily grounds in the other. The U.S. system takes much longer. And often the only way to get to Canada is to pass through the U.S., and that means that then you can't get into Canada unless you have this anchor relative. So it creates a number of problems. The biggest problem, though, is for folks who can only get to Canada by passing through the U.S., and then they don't have an anchor relative. And so they're then forced to go through this kind of loophole, which is that if you show up in the interior of Canada like Fernando did, that you can waive the requirement, but it creates this perverse incentive to cross the border in risky ways. In fact, in addition to Fernando, I interviewed another guy who showed up and asked where the railroad bridge was. And this is another very common crossing that people take, where they hop a train on a railroad bridge on the Niagara River just upstream from Niagara Falls. So, I mean, the peril is abundant there. You have to run and jump onto a moving freight train. If you somehow jump off in the wrong way and fall into the river, you're in danger of getting swept over the falls. But this guy, Jonathan, who I follow, does this, and he takes this enormous risk. And then once he makes it to the other side, he gets his asylum in Canada. So this is kind of this weird situation that this treaty has created, that is inducing people to take these pretty terrible risks.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to granting asylum, what are the differences between Canada and the U.S.?
Well, one thing, I mean, for example, with both Fernando and Jonathan's story, they were both fleeing gang violence. They both were basically, if they had stuck around, Fernando was from Colombia, Jonathan was from, I believe, El Salvador. And if they had stuck around in their home country, they would be killed. In the U.S., gang violence is not grounds for asylum. In Canada, it is. There's also aspects of domestic violence that, if you're fleeing, that it's easier to get asylum in Canada than the U.S. So there are a number of categories that the U.S. doesn't kind of consider legitimate grounds. And now, under the Trump administration, it's become even harder to claim asylum in the U.S. So the overlap is even less.
Let's go to some phone calls. Pat in Wauwatosa, hi.
Hi, I do have a question and a comment, but you were just talking as I got through talking to the person taking the calls. I still don't understand. They can't get into the. Is there some agreement with the United States or three-country agreement or something that if they appear at the border without a relative, Canada can't accept them and refugees?
So there's what it's called is the Safe Third Country Agreement. And the idea basically is if you land in the U.S. first, you got to apply for asylum in the U.S. If you land in Canada first, you got to apply for asylum there. However, they say if you land in the U.S. and you have an anchor relative in Canada, you can continue on to Canada. And the idea is that they want you to stay in the country where you first land. But the problem now is that everyone wants to go to Canada, and the only way to get to Canada for many of these folks is to pass through the U.S. And so it creates this backlog at the Canadian border where unless you have a Canadian relative, you can't continue on to Canada. And then there's this loophole in the law that says, hey, if you cross the border illegally and show up in the interior of Canada, that requirement is waived, which has kind of created this incentive for all these folks to cross the border illegally into Canada. It's a glitch in the treaty that has created this very risky exodus that I document for the people in the story.
Are there Canadians who are concerned about that glitch and trying to change it, Jake?
Yeah, there are. There are people that are saying, hey, this treaty needs to be amended. It needs to be scrapped altogether. We're worried about when the snow melts, what bodies we're going to find underneath the snow.
Yes, that's my comment. When I go to the library, I read McLean's, which is a Canadian monthly, and they had a story this month about people going through fields in North Dakota in the middle of winter, and they had quite a feature, a poor man who lost all his fingers. I mean, they are that desperate. That's why I just wanted to say that's why your article was especially interesting to me and so well done. My daughter was taking an airplane trip. I said, well, here's your reading material for the way. So thank you very much for your story.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Pat, very much for the call. As you met with people and with staff at Vive, and we have to talk more about Vive, which is quite a place, what did people say would be the humane and doable solution to all of this? What role the United States should have?
I think that look, we can't take everyone. We never have in our history been able to, and we can't. But I think that, first of all, we have to. There's a massive humanitarian crisis, the largest number of displaced people since World War II. And instead of kind of trying to step up to accommodate this, we're actually now pulling back. So I think the very least we can do is, honor our commitment that we had, under the Obama administration, which was something on the order of, 100,000 people that we would take in. So I think we can take in some folks. I think we need to figure out a better system with Canada so that, that I understand that you don't want people applying for asylum in both countries and kind of, taking up, all the resources for these kind of, the kind of duplication of this. But, there needs to be a way that we need to eliminate this incentive to cross the border illegally and take these risks. I think at Vive itself, they're almost in triage. Like, they're not even able to think about kind of big policy stuff. They're so overwhelmed with the number of people that are showing up every day. And just one point that's worth making here is that the process in Canada is quite speedy. It usually takes about 60 days to resolve whether you get asylum or not. In the United States, it can take years. I mean, as much as a decade.
Ooh.
And you have people who are basically at Vive hoping to get asylum in the U.S. who have been in the building for months and sometimes even years. And these are the kind of long-term residents. And there's I think another thing that we can do is we can try to expedite our process a little bit so that you don't have people kind of in this kind of prolonged sense of limbo of am I even going to be able to stay here? Yeah.
And then you've got at Vive people who may be pregnant, close to giving birth, people who have breast cancer, who need medical treatment.
Yeah, all of that's true. There was a Pakistani couple where they had a child. She was pregnant, and they were pushing to get to Canada so that the baby could be born on Canadian soil. I think probably the single most poignant story that I encountered was a man about my age, I'm about 40, who was from El Salvador. His name was Ulysses. And Ulysses had made the journey from El Salvador to Canada once before and not won asylum and had been deported. Mm. And then years later, he tried again with his 16-year-old son. And when he shows up at Vive the second time, because he had passed through Vive once before with the son, he talked to them about his chances of making it to Canada. And they said to him, look, Ulysses, your chances are not very good because you've been deported once before. They probably won't let you in at the border. But if your son goes as an unaccompanied minor, they will probably let him in because that's the other exception to the rule. You can have an ANCA relative or you can be an unaccompanied minor, and they will let you in to Canada at the U.S. border to make your asylum claim. So he was faced with this very horrible choice, which was either he stayed in Vive in the United States and began this kind of torturously long process for asylum, which probably wouldn't end well because they were mainly fleeing gang violence, mm-hmm. or he could basically let his son continue, his 16-year-old son continue on alone to Canada. And he eventually decides to do that.
He did.
And so the son goes to Hamilton, Ontario, and is living with another refugee family there. Months pass. He hasn't seen his kid in about half a year, and the boy calls up and says, Dad, we're going to Niagara Falls today. Huh. Why don't you go to the American side, I'll go to the Canadian side, and we can wave at each other.
No.
So Ulysses, it's a very real danger to him because he doesn't have legal standing in the U.S., and he can be picked up by Border Patrol, but he's so desperate to lay eyes on his son that he manages to get to Niagara Falls, to this area where you can kind of put a quarter in a viewfinder, and he does this, and he looks across the kind of misty chasm of the falls and sees ever so faintly the image of his 16-year-old son waving to him across this massive roaring river. And he told me the story. I mean, just telling it again, I almost get choked up.
Yeah, you're making me choked up. That's
yeah.
Sure.
I said to him, Ulysses, I have a 10-year-old boy. You know, God, I just can't imagine. And he just convulsed into sobs.
Mm.
And Sister Beth, who was the nun who was there, kind of as a social worker, kind of just lovely lady, kind of takes him away and kind of comforts him. And then I see him like 15 minutes later, and he's kind of regained his composure and is welcoming a new group of people into Vive and showing this kind of extraordinary grace and resilience that gives you pause, so humbling, so amazingly humbling to see what some people are able to endure.
Yes.
Man, I got home from that trip, and my 10-year-old and my 8-year-old boy came in, and they ran and hugged, you know, me because Daddy had come home. And there were just tears streaming down my face because it was just, it just gave you such pause. We take it for such granted, the simple, you know, the simple freedoms that we have to be in peace with our family.
Right.
And we just forget how lucky we are. How just incredibly lucky we are.
And how unfair the world can be.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now you got me crying.
Yeah.
I know. All right, let's go to phone calls, more of them. 800-486-8655. Ivan in Jefferson. Hi.
Yeah, your story is very tear-jerking, but I come from it at a different side. That is that I've had my Social Security number stolen twice by these people, and they seem to have more rights than I do. There was nothing done to them.
Who are these people, Ivan? Who are you talking about?
These people. There was a Spanish gentleman twice. My Social Security was stolen. I hunted him down. I showed the police where he was. I showed the employer that used my Social Security number. They did absolutely nothing. So when I retired, there was all kinds of more money in there, and I was not allowed to collect any of my retirement until I burned off all of the extra payment that was put in due to somebody using my Social Security number, plus the fact that it went back to all of the government, being the Fed and like that, that my social and my tax returns were not correct for a number of years, and it just destroyed my life.
Jake.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you, Ivan. I wrote a book about debt collecting, and I know the kind of scams that go on and identity theft, the havoc that it wreaks on people's lives, and that stinks. And that I'm sorry that happened to you. I would say, though, that on some level, this is not necessarily or entirely the fault of this guy who had your number. I mean, maybe he was complicit in some ways, but this is also a really crummy system. In which people that are living here and working here, and I don't know how long this guy has been, there should be a system in place by which they can do that without having to steal someone else's Social Security number so that he doesn't put you in the situation where you get your whole life gets derailed, or he can work honestly and both of you can kind of live and enjoy a bit of the American dream. So I think I would say that I hear you, but in some ways it's the government that's failed you as much as anyone.
Well, what about the government here in this whole situation? We've got Syrian refugees who are living in refugee camps, so many of them who have left Syria. We've got, as you said, a real crisis, a worldwide crisis on our hands. Somebody has to step up here and have humanitarian concerns at the forefront. This isn't a good way for all of us to be living, or for people not to be able to find a home somewhere. I'm in a quandary as to how we should be handling all of this.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, I think that what this kind of reminds us is that we're more interconnected than maybe we realize or care to admit. I mean, this idea that we can somehow isolate ourselves from the rest of the world and just kind of put up these walls, I don't think it's true. If there's something calamitous going on in one part of the world and it causes this mass migration, we have to, in some ways, be tuned into it and dealing with it in a proactive way, or else it's going to eventually come back to cause, like, you know, major problems for us. So I think that yes, I think that part of that means that we can't. The answer here is not simply to take everyone that's been displaced. Part of the problem has obviously got to be to stabilize the condition in a place like Syria,
right,
where all these folks are coming from. This is apolitical. Obama, I mean, it's not like, you know, we may disagree with the way that Trump is handling the refugee crisis, but the Obama's administration's policies for Syria weren't exactly a paragon of success. But I think that doesn't mean the answer is not to retreat and to say, well, you know, let the rest of the world deal with this, because eventually it will come back to haunt us.
More phone calls in a moment. Thanks for yours, Ivan. We have a lot of messages coming in, and you're certainly welcome to join the conversation. I urge you to read the piece. It's beautifully written, and Jake went to a lot of work, spending a lot of time with people who were asylum seekers at this safe house in Buffalo, very close to the Canadian border, very close to Niagara Falls, how people try to get to Canada. If they don't have an anchor family somewhere in Canada, the risks that they take to their own lives, why they are here. It's a very, very moving story. It's in the March 13 issue of The New Yorker. We have it posted on our Facebook page if you want to make it easy on yourself and have access to that. It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Jake is quite a journalist. He is the author of several books. Most recent is Bad Paper, Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors, which was a bestseller last year. We'll have to interview him on that book. I didn't see that book. It escaped me somehow, but that would be an interesting interview. Also, he's producing an ongoing series for the New York Times, a nonfiction graphic novel that follows a Syrian family to this country. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, The Atlantic. He's a contributor to NPR's All Things Considered and This American Life. And he's currently a fellow of Morris College at Yale University, where he teaches a class on journalism. Lines are open for you. 800-486-8655. The number, the email is ideas@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. Kenneth sends this email, Jake. He wants to know who's funding the safe house for asylum seekers. And I also wanted to ask you, I know that they worry about people raiding this. Do you worry with the publicity that you've given this house that they face an increased risk of being raided?
Well, those two questions are kind of interesting because they kind of go hand in hand. I think that the folks that, first of all, Vive is funded largely by donations from the public. There's a, they're kind of run by a parent organization called Jericho Road. If you look up Vive or Jericho Road, you go to their website. So they, I mean, they have a website. It's all kind of above board.
I see.
And you can donate money through that. It was an organization founded by a convent of sisters of the Catholic Church. I think it's a calculated risk they let me in the door. I think they were probably hoping that, A, people might be moved by the stories and donate and kind of help them make ends meet in terms of their bottom line, and maybe also hoping that the publicity would offer them some protection, that now that people know about it, that it would be harder for them to be shut down. I think that it's also worth saying that they've had a pretty healthy relationship with the U.S. Border Patrol and ICE. They've done their best to kind of cooperate wherever they can find common ground, and they try to kind of make it a working relationship, and they have not been raided yet, but I think it's a possibility. So far, they haven't, and mm-hmm. I'm glad I haven't brought the roof down on them.
Have more people donated as a result of the article?
I don't know. I know a lot of people emailed me personally and said I was inspired by the stories, and I directed them to the website. So I would guess that was the case, but I don't know for sure.
Let's go to Barb in Sister Bay. Hi, Barb.
Hi. Thanks for the show. This is your stories are amazing. My point is that a lot of the battles that create the refugees, a lot of these wars, the refugee situations, are really proxy battles fought by Western countries and in certain parts of the world. And the companies that make a lot of money on these wars are the munition companies that create the arms that can create the wars, and everybody on both sides are being supplied by Western, in some case, Western companies. So if there was a way to, for a company that wanted to sell munitions in a country to have to pay a tariff or some sort of tax so that you can deal with the refugee situations that occur, I mean, that's kind of pie in the sky, but what do you think about that? And I'll take your answer off the air.
All right, Barb, thanks.
Thanks, Barb. I should preface this by I'm not a policy expert by any means, so I can only kind of give you my layman's take here, but I mean, I like the spirit of the idea, which is that basically that these refugee crises don't happen in a vacuum, that you're right, that they are sometimes proxy wars. You can see what's happening in Syria is like us refighting the old Cold War with Russia on one side and the U.S. on the other, and certainly there are arms manufacturers who are making this possible. Look, that's not to say that we are entirely to blame or we should beat ourselves silly with guilt, but I think that the idea that that there are many people that may have a hand in this who don't necessarily aren't eager to admit that, and that we should find a way to make or to encourage or make people help come up with a solution to a problem that they may have had some hand in creating makes sense to me. How we do that exactly, I'm not sure, but I think that what's clear to me is that the idea that we can somehow just keep this at an arm's length and pretend it's not going to affect us is just deeply misguided. And in the end, not in our own best interest. Even if you are an America First person, I think that you're probably realizing that it's in our own best self-interest to try to stabilize the situation elsewhere so that we don't have people slipping under the, you know, the crack in the door.
Tell me more about how people spend their time at Vive. They can't go in the neighborhood. It's very dangerous, and you run the risk of being picked up by a border patrol. What goes on within the walls?
So there's the people that pass through on the way to Canada, but the people that are there, like Ulysses, the man who was separated from his son, who's been there for months and months, I think it's extremely challenging. I think it's like a prison of sorts. Marshall, who's this guy from Zimbabwe who I met, said to me, he lives in a dorm with 20 people, and he said, at night, if you went into the room at night, he said, you'd think the room was awake, because everyone is babbling and chanting and singing and murmuring and crying. So racked are most of the people by nightmares from the things that they have escaped that there is just this cacophony of kind of anguish that comes from the old classroom and down the hallways. And he also said to me that sometimes he'll find himself sitting in the hallway and just staring off into space and kind of zoning out where he's lost track of time, and someone will poke his shoulder and he won't feel it, and then he'll poke it again and he'll say, sorry, how long have you been there? And I think there's a kind of trance that people fall into. So I think it's not, if you're imagining this as some sort of pleasant existence of people kind of living, it's not. I think these are very trying circumstances.
Dan is next in Franksville. Hi, Dan.
Howdy. The overall narrative that you hear over and over again about immigrants coming to America, I never lost this argument when I've argued with people. Almost all immigrants, without exception, they don't want to come to America. They're familiar with everything, their language, everything in these other countries. They're only coming here because they're forced to come here. You know, we keep hearing the narrative that America's great and people come here for the freedom, this and that. They actually don't come here for that. It doesn't even make sense that they would come here because it's not their country. They didn't grow up around it. They know nothing about it. So all this utopia stuff about people wanting to come here, you know, why should we let them in? And, we got our freedom. Even this whole country was stolen. It's almost ludicrous, but I think I'm getting off track. But
no, you've been on track. Thanks, Dan. Jake?
I don't know. I guess I would. There's an element to it. Now maybe you're right. I mean, now maybe, the mood in the country is such that people aren't looking here and thinking this is going to be a great place for, a refugee or an immigrant, given the kind of mood in the country. But I would push back against this idea a little bit, or maybe a lot, that I think historically that's exactly why people have come here. That's why the pilgrims came here. That's why the Irish came here during the potato famine.
Right.
That's why the Jews came here running from the pogroms. That's why the poor Italians came here from Sicily and from the southern parts of Italy. I mean, this is our narrative. This is not a new story. Everyone in this country except the Native Americans and the people that were brought here as slaves came here because things were bad where they were originally from, and they embarked with the hope that maybe life would be better here. And that hope is in the DNA of most of our ancestors. The story of Fernando and of all these other people that are trying to get across, it is our collective story. It's my family's story. It's many of the people that are listening to this story. And I think it's important to remember that. This isn't some sort of alien invasion. This is what has made this country great. Ironically, this idea of make America great, this is what has made America great.
Mm. Thanks, Dan, for the call. Claire in Madison, our last caller, almost out of time. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Kathleen. I'll be brief. What I was going to say ties in perfectly with what Jake just said. Republicans like to say the mantra, take responsibility, personal responsibility. Well, isn't that exactly what these people are trying to do? They're fleeing famine. They're fleeing war. They're fleeing climate change. They're trying to take personal responsibility and make their lives better.
Jake.
I agree. And the lives of their children. They want their children to have, like, often it's like even what's so poignant is the realization that their lives won't necessarily be better because they will never have the education. They won't realize the American dream. But by God, maybe their kids will if they work hard enough and can live in a place where there's a decent school and can support their kids, if their kids can grow up to become people who contribute, people who are part of this experiment that is our country. I agree. And I know there's all kinds of evidence to back it up about immigrants and refugees being among the hardest working among us, because it took precisely that sort of initiative to get here in the first place.
Right. Jake, thank you. It's an extraordinarily moving story. Congratulations. It must have been very hard to write, but it's so important. Thank you for writing it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, our pleasure. And we'll get him on that book, Bad Paper Inside the Secret World of Debt Collectors. Thanks so much to Scotty Myers. By the way, today is Scotty's last day here. I can't believe I'm saying that. But if you want to go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and wish him well, he's going to Channel 1036, public television in Milwaukee. And we will miss him desperately. And Colleen Duvall's birthday is today. She's doing on-air production, so wish her a happy birthday. So news is coming up. And thanks to Colleen for doing on-air production the first hour of the show. Who thought this was a good idea? Hour two.